You're listening to Hearing Our Heritage, the podcast where we preserve the voices and stories of the older generation and make them accessible to younger ears. We pay tribute to those who have paved the way and learn from their lived experiences. I'm your host, Katie Pierce.
I'm Anna Marie Wilstead. My maiden name is Hulls, and I was born January 26, 1950, born in Durango, Colorado.
Name is Richard Wilstead. Birthday is November 6, 1947. My family lived in Provo at the time when I was born.
Anna and Richard Wilstead are a wonderful couple from Arizona. They have been married since 1969 after meeting when Anna was just 16 and Richard 19. Together, they have seven children: Lorianne, Gregory, Jeffrey, Elizabeth, Kenneth, Curtis, and Deborah. They have worked hard their entire lives, since they were young teens, to provide for themselves and their family. They have both had fascinating experiences in a variety of careers, but the best part of their life has been raising their kids and all that that entailed. They are both faithful members of the church and love all of their kids and grandkids so much.
We lived in Mancos, Colorado. And so my mom said that she had to go to the hospital early, like a couple of weeks early, because she would never be able to make it in the snow and in the mountain roads in Colorado. All my parents moved our family to Arizona. My dad got a job here, and we didn't know anybody, 1956. But I mean, I do remember the trip. We were all just stuffed in a car because there were eight of us and driven to Arizona in the middle of the night. I remember parking outside the house that we were going to rent or buy. I'm not sure what it was. And we slept all over the lawn. We lived there for, I think, a couple of years and then moved down the street and lived there for a few years and then moved across the other way. I have just a few memories in each house, but we stayed within pretty much a quadrant mile or two my whole childhood. We were really poor, but everybody was poor. We never asked our parents for money because we knew they didn't have any money. Never asked. There were four girls and four boys in our family. And I was number six out of eight. And I shared a room with my two sisters. One of them's 5 years older than the other one's just 16 months younger than me. Then my sister got married. And then I shared a room with my little sister. And she said that she hated it when I got married because she didn't like having the room all by herself. My dad was a carpenter. I don't have any memories of Colorado, but I guess that he had a lot of jobs there. He was a postman for a while. He was a cook inside the mines for the miners.
And he worked at a flour mill where he got his eye poked out.
Yeah. And so for the rest of his life, he had a glass eye. And every once in a while, he'd take it out to tease us. He took it out to wash it and then put it back in. But he'd pretend like that he popped it in his mouth and we all freaked out. And my mother, she never had an outside job. She just raised us eight kids and did a good job. My mom is the lively one. My dad is very reserved. My dad was a bishop for 5 or 6 years and he was very soft-spoken, hardly ever got mad, just always nice. My mom was nice too. She had a little potty mouth on her once in a while. And she says that when she was a little girl, she threw rocks and cussed. And then she says, and then I grew up and I stopped throwing rocks, but she still cussed. And then she always made bread. Everything was homemade. Once in a while, we went out and got hamburgers, or we went to the Dairy Queen, or we went to Dog and Suds, where they sold mugs of root beer and you could put ice cream in them. We did a lot of playing outside with our friends. I mean, that's what we did most. We never had air conditioning in our house because nobody did. It was all an evaporated cooling. So it was very, very humid inside the house. And we lived in small houses, so there wasn't really a lot to do inside of a house. And so we did a lot of playing. I remember my dad built stilts. If the neighbor kids didn't have it, he would build them some. I took home ec in high school because we couldn't afford to buy anything. And so I fell in love with sewing, and my mom sewed everything that we had, and just listened to a lot of music. We had a stand-up radio in our bedroom. I can still remember when a transistor radio came, we thought we died and went to heaven. So, you know, that was fun. First, I went to Franklin when I was in kindergarten, but then we just went to school just down the street from where we lived, Lowell Grade School. And then in seventh and eighth grade, I went to the junior high, which was right next to the grade school. And in ninth grade, I went to Mesa High School, which was downtown Mesa. And when I was a senior, somebody set the school on fire. It was built in 1900 and it burnt down. It was really tragic. So I spent the rest of my senior year in cubicles. He went to Westwood and I went to Mesa High.
My mom's side of the family, they were the settlers of Springville. They built the first home in Springville. Their property was right where the cemetery is in Springville. And my mom was raised in a house that her dad built. So my memory of my mom and her family as a boy were not real frequent trips, but kind of frequent to Springville to visit them. I do a lot of genealogy. So my grandfather on my mom's side went on a mission to the eastern states. That's where his mission was. And he came home and they proceeded to have, I think, 7 kids. And so my mom was like a middle child in that group. And her dad was also a carpenter. That's what he did for a living. And his dad was a carpenter. And his dad was John White Curtis. And his dad was Enos Curtis, who taught Brigham Young and his family back in Pennsylvania when they joined the church. So that's my fourth great grandfather was Enos Curtis. He was actually sent by Joseph Smith to go over and visit the Young family because Samuel Smith met his brother, who was a minister with the Methodist Church, I think, at the time. And so they went and they were told to go visit, and that's how Brigham Young got introduced to the church. There were 6 men that went over to visit with the prophet in Kirkland, and he in turn asked them to go back into Pennsylvania, into the northern part up by New York, and find the Young family, which they did. So that's how my family joined the church. He was one of the first members of the church way, 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 way back. My family on my mom's side came west in the very first group that came. And Enos Curtis was with them along with one of his sons, John White, which was my third great-grandfather. He was the one that settled in Springville. So my family was well-rooted right there in Springville. All my family is from South Wales, and Western England, UK. So they all came over in 1881 because my great-grandfather didn't like working in the coal mines in the UK because they were all about 4 feet tall. You had to bend over all day. And so when he came to the States, he didn't have to bend over, and that's why he ended up over here working in the coal mines in Castledale, and that's why he died in that Schofield mine disaster, along with one of his boys. And that's why Willie is named after one of those boys, which was William Willstead. And so he died in that disaster, and he told his wife, my great-grandmother, not to join the church. She went ahead and did it after he died. My dad was in the Air Force. So was his brother. My dad's mother was really big into music. She taught him how to play the piano. She taught him how to do a lot of things. And so when he got into college, my dad, he was, I think, one semester away from graduating when World War II broke out, so he didn't get to graduate. But he was in the band. He had his own dance band. He played the bass fiddle. And so when he got inducted, and at the induction center, they found out that he could play a musical instrument. So they took him and they put him in a dance band that traveled throughout the Pacific Ocean areas, the islands where he played in for the officers' clubs. And so that's what he did all during World War II. Now, he had a brother that was in the Bataan March. So my family was well-rooted right there in Springville. That's why my mom was there, and that's where my dad met my mom. And from there, they moved up to Montana, and then they moved back to Logan. So my first memories of anything is Logan, Utah. And my dad opened up a car dealership in Logan, and he and another man who was his financial backer opened this dealership up. And they traveled over to Las Vegas to buy cars, and they would bring them back into Utah, and they would sell them. Well, that upset all the other dealerships in town. So they did a class action lawsuit against my dad. And my dad ended up losing everything because of that, because they put a cease and desist on my dad for selling cars, so he couldn't sell anything, didn't have any income. And he was going into court one day, and the retiring state attorney general heard about the case. And so he was there waiting for my dad when he got to the courthouse. And he told everybody that he was going to represent my dad pro bono. And so when that happened, all the dealerships dropped their law case against my dad. But the damage was already done. And so he had a friend that lived down in Mesa who worked at the car dealership down here. So my dad came down here, got a job selling cars, and left my mom to sell the house, sell the furniture, and to pack us all on a Greyhound bus and come down to Mesa. In December 1950, my younger brother and myself were the two youngest. So there were four of us that came down on the bus. Everybody else was born in Mesa, which there were three other siblings. So my family ended up coming down to Mesa in December 1955. And I started school like everybody else did.
What school
was it? It was over at the new old Webster School. And then I went to Irving School, and I went to Alma School. My dad moved around a lot. We didn't own a house. We rented. So I lived in three homes before my dad bought a home. And it was on opposite corners of Mesa from where my wife, Hannah, was raised. And Westwood was the new high school. And I played high school football all the way through my senior year. I wasn't great, but I wasn't bad. I mean, It was 4 years of high school football. I had a good time in high school, had a lot of friends. I still have a lot of friends from high school. And I went about finding all of my classmates. There were 723 that were my graduating class. And so I spent my first months of retirement looking for all of that class. And I found over 320 of them.
That people couldn't find.
That had never been found before. I really enjoy finding people and connecting the dots. As far as me working, I worked from the time I was 14 years old all the way up until the time I went on my mission. I worked every summer in the hay industry. I worked for a man that baled hay as a contractor. And so, I mean, I was driving a car when I was 14 years old to and from each and every job. And so I would work, like I say, all every day from about 6 o'clock at night until about 7 o'clock the next morning, all for $1 an hour.
Yeah.
But my parents never gave me any money. So I always had money and I always had a car, and I ended up buying my own car my junior year in high school, and I paid cash for it. And it's because I had money, and it was not because I got it from my dad, but because I worked for it.
I was working probably from the time that I was 12 years old. I would babysit I would be constantly babysitting my sister and I. And then when I was 15, I actually went to work at a movie theater in the concession stand. And I worked there for a couple of years. And then right after high school, I went to work at a sewing factory, and because I loved to sew, and they made lingerie for Sears. And I worked there for 2.5 years until I was like 7 months pregnant with our first child. You know, we paid for our own wedding, which I think was $300. When I was 16 and he was almost 19. So we met during the summer of 66, and it was called a Mazona there was a big dance hall owned by the church, and it was called the Mazona.
But every Saturday night, they would have a dance.
Every single Saturday night, so which was cool because, I mean, half of everybody in Mesa met their spouses at the Mazona. So I remember he asked my sister to dance first because she's this gorgeous blonde. And then he asked me to dance second, and we just clicked back. And
I didn't know she was keeping score.
Yeah, I'm keeping score. He told me that he was going with this girl for about 2 years, and she went out of town with her family, and she told him that, oh, don't sit home. You can go to that dance if you want to.
I had a girlfriend in high school, and we dated all my senior year.
Well, he told me that one thing that made him really like me is when he met me at the dance, the next week he came back to the dance because his girlfriend went out of town again. And I made the mistake of saying to him, oh, did Janice let you out again? It's just a joke. And he goes, bits of sarcasm hurt. And he got in his car and he just drove off. And I thought, oh, crap. So I found out where he lived and I wrote him a letter, an apology letter, and sent it to his house. And he said, that was so nice of her to do that. So that was one thing that he said that he liked.
What she said.
You don't remember any of that, do you?
No, I don't.
Back then, the way you courted a girl is that you would drive by her house. You'd find out where she lived, and then you just make drive-bys. And hopefully, she'll see you in the window. And when Richard was driving by my house, he would drive by in a different car every time. And it was a new car. I thought this guy was loaded. Plus, he dressed really nice. I thought, oh my gosh, he's rich and cute and nice. But I honestly thought that he was loaded and he was just borrowing his dad's demo cars. But the funny thing about it is that his girlfriend's sister lived right on his path of coming over to my house. And so she would see him drive by to my house. My dad and her dad worked together. And so my dad, I guess I must have told my dad all about Richard. He said, oh yeah, my daughter met this guy. She really likes him. Back then, Mesa was small. So the guy said, oh, what's his name? And he said, Richard Wilstead. And he goes, oh, he's in my ward. He's been dating my daughter for a couple of years. And then one day, he and his girlfriend broke up, one of their many times of breaking up. And then he called me and asked me out on a date. And then he said that the day that he was supposed to take me out on the date, they got back together. But he told her, he says, I'm still going out on the date. I'm not going to break the date. So anyway, so we went to the Mesa Theater and watched two movies, and it was really fun. And we really just really connected. I only had one date with him before he left because he left in November of that year. And I remember that I was sick in bed with the flu, and he came over to my house to tell me goodbye. And my mother let him back in the bedroom, and my hair was plastered down to my head, and I held the pillow up in front of my face. But he wanted me to write to him. And he said, Janice is going to write to me too. So we were basically just friends.
Richard was off to serve a mission for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
I went to Chile, South America in 1968. Interesting topic. The other day I was contacted. I received a text message from a person I didn't know. And he says, I want to know, are you the person who baptized my dad down in Chile? And I says, well, who's your dad? And he gave me the name. And I said, yes, I did. There I got a chance to go over and visit with him and his wife. He had six kids. He came to the States. He married a returned missionary from Chile. And he's worked for the church his entire life. His name was Guillermo Antivilo.
These kids were active. They all got married in the temple. They all served missions.
Oh, it was a good experience to find somebody you actually baptized.
Back in those days, foreign missionaries served for a little bit longer, so Richard ended up serving for 27 months.
So we wrote the whole 27 months. I was still dating, and I went with this one guy really steadily in high school my whole senior year. But there was just something about Richard that I just knew that's the one that I wanted. And so I broke it off with that one guy, broke his heart. I just felt something about Richard. I had his picture on my dresser the whole time he was gone. He really was extremely handsome. It was just something about him and the way he talked to me. And then all while he was writing to me on his mission, we just talked about all sorts of things. And I remember buying a set of pots and pans, because back then you had to, you bought things ahead of time for your wedding. And I can remember telling him that I bought a whole big set. It was like a $99, and I was making payments on it. And he was excited about that. And about a year or so into his mission, we were talking about not marriage, but we were talking about our lives together afterwards. And he finally got to the point where he said, "You are going to marry me, right?" So that was my proposal. He had sent me a really pretty ring. He sent it home with another missionary, and the missionary came over and gave it to me. And then Richard came home on March 1st, and I have pictures at the airport with us walking beside each other, and he actually had his arm around me, and his parents were just really looking at me saying, "You guys, he hasn't been released yet. You guys have to slow things down." But it just took a little while of, because we saw each other every single night until the day we got married. We were in love. We just couldn't stand to be apart.
My biggest fear is having somebody that wasn't being straight with you. And I didn't have that concern with her.
We were married on July 12th. Since we didn't have air conditioning, I remember I had gone and gotten my hair done the day before. So I woke up and my hair was just gummed to my head. I remember I had to get up and wash it and style it myself because it was just gross. And then so we got married in the Mesa Temple, and it was in July, in the hottest part of the year. And after all the pictures, we then had a luncheon that we went to. So I went back to the apartment they were going to be renting and washed and curled my hair again, because it was just completely flat by then. But it was nice. We had a lot of flowers. We had a lot of pictures. It was a nice wedding. I had my best friends being my bridesmaids, and then my sister being my maid of honor. And it was fun.
At the very beginning of their marriage, Richard was sent off with the Army National Guard.
He was going to get drafted, and so he ran down and signed up for the National Guard, so at least he wouldn't have to go to war. He signed up for the National Guard, and the very next day he got his draft induction papers. So he made it by one day. So six weeks after we were married, he left me for 5 months. He was in Oklahoma. It's in the middle of the winter time, and we couldn't stand it. So I went and stayed there, like in a hotel room, for the end of the six weeks.
We actually moved in with another couple. We rented an apartment, the two couples.
She was 7 months pregnant, and I got pregnant probably the first night. And so I was sick the whole time. I still worked until I was like 7 months pregnant. She was born in August. And then right after I had her, I actually got belly fever. I mean, within a couple of weeks after I had her. The way that it affected me is that all of my joints, my elbows and my knees and my ankles, they all locked up on me. It was very painful. So I think I was in bed for 3 or 4 weeks, but I had to stop nursing my child. So I didn't get to nurse her, which was sad for me because she was my very first one. You know, I got pregnant so fast with her, but with Greg, he came exactly 3 years after she did. So he was born in August, 3 years after Lori. So I didn't think that my kids were going to come very fast. That kind of scared me. But 18 months after Greg, I had another one. And then I had a miscarriage later. And so between the third one and the fourth one is 2.5 years. That was Elizabeth. And then she was only a year and a half old. And then I had a set of twins. And they were 12 months old. And I had my last one. I had told Richard we were going to have 12 kids. And then when I was pregnant with number 7, we both looked at each other and we go, "We're done." So in 2.5 years, I had 4 kids. And it was hard because I was babysitting. That's what I did for a living, is I babysat. And I didn't babysit just one or two little kids. I babysat a lot for 20 years. And you made a pretty good living with it.
Anna worked hard babysitting in her home for 20 years. She then moved on and tried out some different jobs. Likewise, Richard got to experience a wide variety of careers.
I applied for a job with the sheriff's office. I got hired on with Maricopa County Sheriff's Office, and I went to work in downtown Phoenix at the Madison Street Jail, they call it. And I took prisoners back and forth to court every day. I was a court deputy. So for like 2 years, I took them back and forth to Superior Court and to Justice Court. So that's what I did. And then I applied to go out on the street, and I was a street deputy, you know, patrolling different communities out here where we live now. And back then there was hardly any people out there. But anyway, and one of those nights, a guy named Russell Pierce, and he was a deputy on the street the same time I was. And I was patrolling like 25 miles to the east, and he was patrolling in a little community called Guadalupe. And that night he got shot down there, and the news put it out on the 10 o'clock news, and she miscarried. I didn't even know what had happened, and yet here the news is putting it on 10 o'clock news. And she knew that I was out on patrol that night, and so she thought it was me that got shot.
I wasn't a very good cop's wife.
Shortly thereafter, I stopped my career, and I knew I was going to quit, so I took real estate school. And then an incident took place where I was chasing two guys on motorcycles, and the dirt was all, it was the middle of the summer. He flipped his motorcycle in front of me, and I ran over the top of him with the car. And the guy that was running the department at the time got all huffy about the whole thing, and that's when I decided to quit. And so I went to work selling real estate. And I sold real estate for a few years, and then there was a period of time before that that I was selling food for a distributor. And then after the real estate thing got bad, I went back to selling food again. That's what I did most of my career up until the very last few years.
He was a salesman for like a bunch of restaurants, pizzerias and Mexican restaurants and things. He even got written up in a magazine. We have a plaque of the magazine thing that he got written up on.
Back when I was doing food service, I had several of the largest independent pizzerias that were my clients. And so one of them told me about a guy that was trying to sell one of his pizzerias. And so I went over and talked to the guy, and he agreed to sell it. And so we made payments on it, and we paid off the store over a period of 5 years. And then Greg decided he wanted to get out.
So it employed the kids. They got to work in the kitchen and the register and doing delivery. And all of our kids were teenagers. So in fact, one night we shut it down a little bit early and brought in furniture because my kids were having prom that night. And we decided to have their little get together inside the pizzeria. So we brought in couches and chairs and made it look really cute. And then my twins were back behind the counter making their friends pizza. But it wasn't real profitable. And after 5 years, when the lease was up, we just decided this is the time to get out of it. Everybody still talks about Pacino's. My sister, who they owned a property management company, and they wanted me to come and work for them. And I was pretty burned out with babysitting. I think they were going to pay me like $8 an hour. And so I got my daughter, who was 20 at the time, I got her to agree to come over and watch the kids. And I was going to give her a certain amount of money, and then I was going to take the rest. So in essence, I would make the same money as I was making before. So then I thought I could do that. So I got the parents of the children to say that was okay. So I worked for my sister for a long time. And one time I quit and worked for another management company for a couple of years. And I quit that and went to work for a law firm for a little while that went back into property management, apartment managing for 6 years, and loved it. The last 2 years that I worked there, they needed a maintenance person. Richard had already retired, and we were actually desperate. We just said, we've got to have somebody. And I knew that he just really good at fixing things. So they hired him on. So the last 2 years that I worked there, he was the maintenance manager of the same complex. So that was fun. I got to work with him for a couple of years. I loved it, but the job was huge. I was just responsible for all the employees, plus I was responsible for all the bookkeeping. Most of the time, I didn't get home until 10 o'clock at night. I only get paid up until 5 o'clock. So I called him one time, and I just said, I'm really going to have a nervous breakdown. And my kids, Greg and my son that's a dentist, they said, quit your job and we'll help you with your bills, but you were going to lose you to a heart attack or a stroke or something. It took me about 6 months to really agree to that because we do not like taking from our kids. It's just something we just didn't like to do.
When there's 7 kids at home, there's bound to be chaos. Richard and Anna have their fair share of wild stories from that time of their life.
Richard went on a fishing trip. So I was home with the kids and Greg came in from the garage and he was holding something in his hand and he goes, "Mom, what is this? I found it in Dad's toolbox." And I said, "I don't know, but you better go put it back." And if it were one of my other kids, I would have grabbed it because I wouldn't have trusted Greg. I trusted the fact that he would go take it back.
It was a gas bomb.
Yeah.
From the time that I was in the military.
Yeah.
So what did Greg do? He pulled the pin in the garage.
And there was gas, smoke. It was a mist of stuff that went all over. And he came in to me with his hand all cut up and he goes, "I don't know what happened. I'm so sorry." And at that time, we were choking. The only one that wasn't affected was Lorianne, and she was outside in the backyard. I knew we were all going to die.
And yes, they called the fire department.
No,
and yes, well, and it all, I almost got myself in trouble.
Okay, well, I knew we were going to die because it was burning our throats and our lungs. But I threw my kids in the shower thinking I could wash it off. Well, that only ignites the burning sensation. But we were in the end of the cul-de-sac. The entire cul-de-sac was affected by that. So we had to call 911 and the police were not happy. They went and searched his toolbox, got 2 or 3 more things out there, gave me a dirty look by, he's going to get in trouble. And one of the other policemen came up to me and he goes, "Don't worry about that. I've got stuff like that in my garage too."
If you turn off the ignition on a car and let the engine speed up and then turn the key back on, it would explode the gas that had collected in the exhaust pipe, making it backfire. And so what they did is they did that going down the road beside our house, and the cops thought they were shooting at people. So bottom line is he chased them to our cul-de-sac, and I had 14 cops at the end of the cul-de-sac and cop cars everywhere. And these guys are all up in front of the car, and it was Jeff.
They had the megaphones out and they said, "Everybody stay inside your house." They had each one of the kids back up with their hands out, back, walk back.
In other words, I wasn't popular for about a year and a half after that.
And then another time, my twins, they fed each other aspirin or some kind of pill. When I found out, we couldn't tell how much it was, so they took them to the hospital. And my boys, especially Jeff and Curtis and Kenny, they would go out in the summertime when there wasn't any school, and I was asleep in bed, and they would go out and they'd shoot videos all night long of them doing silly stuff. I'm glad I didn't know half of this stuff. My kids all had pagers at one time, and that was our way of keeping track. So we had 7 pagers in the family, plus he had a pager and I had a pager. So we had this board in our kitchen that had everybody's pagers numbers on them. And the coolest thing that my kids loved is that Richard installed a telephone in the hallway because all of our bedrooms were all together. And so we had a telephone in the hallway with a real long cord. So that was fun because the kids were always on the phone. Oh, Greg was on his mission and he wrote us a letter and he said, "Hey, there's this guy who is going to come to the United States. He actually wants to come. And can you put him up for the night?" And we said, okay. The guy lived with us for 6 weeks. We couldn't get rid of him. And my kids would tease him all the time. And so we had a couple of foreign exchange students. We had the one from Japan that my kids loved. And that was for just a couple of weeks. And then one time when all my kids were teenagers, they were all sitting around the family room watching TV. And it was in the middle of the summertime. And this guy comes through our back door. We're used to tons of our kids' friends coming in and out and whatever. And this guy comes through the back door and just sits on the couch. And everybody just thought that he was a friend of whatever brother and sister. Well, after a few minutes, Greg's girlfriend at the time said, "Who are you?" And she looked at everybody and she goes, "Does anybody know him?" And they said, "No." And he had jumped over our fence and just walked through the back door and sat down. So that was funny.
Mm-hmm.
Curtis and Kenny were about 15. I told the kids that they could have a throw a party because we never threw parties or anything. And I said, okay. It was Debbie and Elizabeth and Curtis and Kenny mostly. That was the age group that, and I said, you can all invite 5 kids because I knew that was going to be a big one. Then you know how it is when somebody says, I'm going to have a party. I bet we had way over 100 people. They talked about that party for years on how much fun it was. We had the trampoline in the back and a big industrial swing set. We had orange trees in the backyard. And so we played music and the entire cul-de-sac was filled up with cars. But that was a party. My kids' friends talked about that for years and years. They still remembered that party. We tried to do what we could, but our Christmases were insane because just couldn't help myself. So the kids, for the most part, they feel like they got treated pretty good. I was probably too lenient. He was a little bit more on the strong-handed side, but more and more, they thought they had a pretty good life.
I enjoyed the kids. I enjoyed the family. I wished I had done a better job of preparing them for the rest of their lives. But you know, when you're young and you're worried more about putting food on the table.
He was a good dad. He really liked the babies. When he got home from work, he just was always helping me with getting the kids ready for bed and doing the dinner. And he was the one who always did the homework and the assignments and all of the making the big projects and stuff. He did all of that. I used to sew for all of my kids. I mean, I sewed everything they wore, from underwear to jackets to suits and Levi's, and I sewed everything. In fact, a cute little story of my little girl, Lori, was my only one for 3 years. And so she looked perfect every time she went out to play or anything. And she came in one time. I said, Lori, you got some dirt on your outfit. And she goes, that's okay, Mom. Tide can get it out. So that was cute. I remember that. And then one time she said, Mom, I need a new dress. And I said, okay, well, when I get time, I'll make you one. And she said, can't you just buy one? And then later on in her life, she said, Mom, I need a new outfit. And I said, okay, I'll go out and buy you one. Can't you make me one? So that was cute. I just like to do crafts and sewing. I mean, my whole thing was I made gifts for everybody. I just like making things and giving them away. I don't go out and buy presents. I'm always on YouTube trying to figure out what to make. I like crocheting. I like crafting. I do all my own cards. I haven't bought a card in years and years. I make them all.
Anna and Richard did such a wonderful job raising their 7 kids. And for Anna, being mom was all that she ever wanted.
I don't have a lot of talents. That is the only thing that I ever wanted to do. I just wanted to get married and have babies. Richard, one time he says, well, later on when you want to go get a job, what would you want to do? And I said, nothing. I just want to stay home, be a mom. And he goes, no, really. What would you really, if you had anything that you wanted to do? And I said, nothing. I just want to stay home, be a mom. We have 27 grandkids. My kids were supposed to grow up and get married and move out, but not move away. And most of them moved away. I only have a couple of kids here in the valley. And the rest of them are moved away. So it's really hard. So we go out and see them once a year. We drive to Texas and we drive to Utah and we drive to Idaho and see the kids.
Both Anna and Richard have been so faithful throughout their lives. They both have a strong testimony of Jesus Christ and his gospel.
The gospel's everything to me. My big thing now is just I love serving. I love being able to find somebody who needs something and take them a meal or be their friend, something. I just love serving. And I do have a testimony. I'm so excited about the gospel and what it's done for our lives and what it means for us eternally and my family eternally. And I have a real firm testimony of the gospel. Nothing can ever shake it. I know that God lives. I know that Jesus lives. I know that we lived there before we came here. I know that we had a strong desire to come here and raise a family and try to get our family back to living in God's presence. And I want to go back and live with my father in heaven and my brothers and sisters that I've lived with for all those years. and continue serving. But I do have a testimony.
My whole thing about the gospel is I have a firm testimony of who Christ is and why we're here, because anything else that the world preaches, totally unfathomable to me. The alternative has no merit. It's the only church in the world that all of the teachings are supported by scripture and by belief and by results. And so for me, it's more of a nuts and bolts type of thing. That experience I had with the young man that I baptized, he said to me when I went to visit him, he says, you know, when you brought out the lessons and you were teaching me, he says, you said no alcohol. He says right then and there that was the one thing that made me know that the church was true, because alcohol is one of the worst things that you can do in your life. He says it ruined my father and it ruined the relationship and my family. So to me, that isn't the nuts and the bolts that I would build my testimony on, but for him, it was. So the church is no one thing, it's all of it. And I have a strong testimony of the gospel.
We did the best that we could being young parents. Now that we're older, we look back and we go, oh, we should have done this and this. But at the time, we did the best that we could. We gave them a good foundation of prayer and scriptures and going to the church and going and partaking of the sacrament, getting baptized, all of the things that parents need to be teaching their kids.
It's not a very eventful life. It's pretty plain Jane. There's nothing magnanimous.
But you know what? It was the kind of a life that we wanted. We're happy with that.
As you've heard, Anna and Richard have a happy life together. It hasn't always been easy, and they've worked so hard for it. But they have all they need with their kids and their grandkids and the gospel. A huge thank you to the Willsteads for purchasing this episode and to Anna and Richard for being interviewed. If there's someone that you would like to have featured on Hearing Our Heritage, email hearingourheritage@gmail.com or visit our website at hearingourheritage.com.